Ground Zero Radio. This is Democracy Now!
Big money! United! The people aren't invited! Big money! United! The people aren't invited!
Bad capitalist, no martini. It's a big party for all the bigwigs. Big cocktail party. I'm ready to go, but I didn't get my invitation.
Crashing the party. Through the police barricades, the metal detectors, and the security checks, a Democracy Now! Exclusive. It's the hottest ticket in town, the gala soiree of the World Economic Forum, Saturday night on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. We take you inside the party of the power elite for a stock market crash, Democracy Now! Style. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. In a series of memorandums to high-ranking Enron executives that began almost a year before the company's collapse, a senior lawyer warned about the appearance of sweetheart deals and dubious transactions. The lawyer, Jordan Mintz, also proposed several ways to correct the problems. However, he's told investigators of the House Energy and Commerce Committee that his efforts were rebuffed. Mintz's memorandums provide fresh evidence that top Enron executives knew early on there were problems with financial partnerships that are now at the center of congressional and criminal investigations. The Mintz memos will figure prominently in today's Energy Committee hearings, where Mintz is expected to be a main witness, and former Enron CEO Jeffrey Skilling is also expected to testify. Skilling is the most senior Enron executive to be questioned about his role in the nation's largest corporate bankruptcy since former Chair Ken Lay declined to testify before a Senate committee earlier this week. In his sharpest words yet on the next phase of the so-called war on terrorism, Secretary of State General Colin Powell declared yesterday there should be a regime change in Iraq and that Washington is prepared to pursue that goal alone if necessary. Until yesterday, Powell had been chief among Bush's advisors in urging caution on Iraq. Powell also had sharp words for Iran and North Korea, the other two countries in Bush's so-called axis of evil. But in contrast to his comments about Iraq, Powell suggested that dialogue with North Korea and some elements in Iran is still possible. Yesterday, U.S. forces in Afghanistan released 27 prisoners captured in a raid last month, saying they were not Taliban or al-Qaeda fighters, as the Pentagon originally claimed. The prisoners' release followed War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's concession this week that U.S. commandos might have mistakenly killed more than 15 friendly Afghans in the same raid. In his first public congressional testimony since the September 11th attacks, CIA Chief George Tenet said yesterday that al-Qaeda was trying to reconstitute itself and remains a serious threat to the United States. Despite the rout of the Taliban and the capture of 1,000 suspected members in 60 countries, Tenet warned the group might attempt unconventional attacks. The greatest risk lay in biological weapons, but he said al-Qaeda was also pursuing chemical and nuclear weapons. On Tuesday, Belgian Foreign Minister Louis Michel expressed sincere regrets on behalf of his government for Belgium's role in the killing of Congolese freedom fighter Patrice Lumumba. Lumumba was the first and only democratically elected leader of what is now the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was overthrown only months after taking office and then murdered by members of a rival Congolese faction in 1961. As for the United States, it has yet to admit or apologize for the CIA's role in Patrice Lumumba's murder. Israel has demolished more than 600 homes, displacing more than 5,000 residents of the Gaza Strip in violation of international law. This, according to a report released this week by Israel's most prominent human rights group, B'Tselem. This since the beginning of the so-called Al-Aqsa Intifada almost 18 months ago. The vast majority of these demolitions took place at night without any warning to residents, some of whom were forced to flee their homes when bulldozers were already at their doorstep, according to the report, which charged that the policy behind the operations amounts to collective punishment forbidden under international law. And France's highest court yesterday upheld a three-month jail sentence for former José Bové over his protest at a McDonald's restaurant for U.S. trade barriers. The ruling announced by the court means the sheep farmer has exhausted all means of appeal against his conviction for the 1999 action against the site of a planned new fast food outlet in the southern French town of Miau. And a Voice of America journalist who scored an exclusive and controversial September interview with the Taliban leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar, has been taken off the air and reassigned to what she and the agency's news director call a useless job. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
Big money! United! The people aren't invited! Big money! United! The people aren't invited!
Bad capitalist, no martini. It's a big party for all the bigwigs. Big cocktail party. I'm ready to go, but I didn't get my invitation.
In life for free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money.
The World Economic Forum has wrapped up its meetings here in New York. The CEOs and heads of state have returned to their countries and their country clubs. Last weekend, thousands descended on New York for massive street protests demonstrating against corporate globalization. The streets were full of people and puppets, drummers and dancers, activists and union leaders. Behind the police barricades, there were dozens of exclusive parties and soirees where the captains of industry rubbed elbows with celebrities, government officials, and world leaders. Some of these parties were so exclusive that even people like billionaire currency speculator George Soros were not invited. Well, Democracy Now! Wasn't invited to any of these galas either. But with a little help from some brave people on the inside of the World Economic Forum, we managed to crash one of these exclusive parties. In fact, it was the party, the hottest ticket in town, held on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. In order to get in, you had to have a special ID badge with a computer chip verifying your identity. The Brazen Bash invited the guests to experience sounds and flavors from around the globe on the trading floor. A celebration of the Americas, a taste of Asia, an evening in Casablanca, and the rhythms of Africa as you sample the exotic fare of Africa. Well, despite the heavy security last Saturday, we headed to Wall Street and made it onto the floor of the stock exchange for the exclusive gala soiree.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money.
The security here is extremely tight, very difficult to get through the police to come in, both out on Wall Street and then once ID was shown, the official World Economic Forum ID that has the computer chip in it of the person that we came with, then it got a little bit easier, although they did say that recording is forbidden. The NYSE welcomes the participants of the World Economic Forum annual meeting and their guests as we celebrate the strength of New York.
There's a drink called Roots.
It's called Roots?
Roots.
And what is that?
Rum, bark, and kola nut.
Rum, bark, and kola nut?
Yeah.
And where is it from?
From Africa.
You know where?
No, I don't.
Wow.
Pretty powerful.
Put it back on the track.
That so-called roots drink from an undisclosed nation somewhere in Africa was certainly not the most powerful thing at the gala. As we made our way through the caviar and champagne, the tuxedos and the tickers showing the rise and fall of stock prices on the floor of the stock exchange, out in the streets, thousands of protesters were being prevented from coming in to these events.
Let us move! Let us move! Let us move! Let us move!
Back inside the party, one of the first power brokers we ran into was Stanley Fisher, the new vice chair of Citigroup. Fisher comes to Citigroup after spending the last 7 years as the number two man at the International Monetary Fund. Before that, he was the chief economist at the World Bank. He's a member of David Rockefeller's Trilateral Commission, along with former Enron CEO Ken Lay, former President Bush, and Henry Kissinger. As for the protesters, he didn't have much to say.
I just wanted to ask, we're trying to get the impressions of people here of the protests that are going on outside and what you think of them. He is Stanley Fisher of Citicorp. He is the vice president.
Stanley Fisher walked away refusing to talk to us. While he didn't have too much to say about the protesters, outside his Citigroup headquarters, they were very vocal.
You can't use megaphones other places. I thought we had freedom of speech in this country, but we do have a permit to use it in this corner right here. And this is a very important corner for everybody out there who cares about a just future. Because do you know who's right across the street from us?
Citigroup,
the world's most destructive bank!
These protesters are from the Rainforest Action Network. Citigroup's the largest financial institution in North America. It financed the Chad-Cameroon pipeline cutting through rainforests and indigenous land. It also helped Maxam Corporation finance the clear-cutting of California's ancient redwoods. And it bankrolls corporations like Monsanto and Wackenhut, one of the world's largest private prison firms. Back on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, we ran into health guru Dean Ornish, stocking up on the chocolate cheese. He, of course, was President Clinton's low-fat diet advisor and golf partner. Ornish's diet programs go for $7,500 a pop. Once he finished his chocolate cheese, he was hungry to talk.
I like the World Economic Forum. I think it's a great way to bring people together with divergent points of view.
I guess a lot of the concern is that the people who are at the Waldorf Astoria, some 2,700, are a very exclusive club that have a disproportionate impact on the world and determining the shape of the global economy.
That's the way it is. And so whether or not that's the way it should be, you can argue about, but that's the way it is, that a small number of people have a disproportionate influence over the world. So given that, I personally think it's a great idea that they get together and find ways to try to solve the world's problems and to use that power in ways that are more productive and healing rather than ones that create more suffering.
But what about taking that power away from such a small, exclusive white group that represents a small number of rich countries and corporations in the world?
What does that mean, to take it away?
That other people have access to the kind of economic levers that more people participate in the decision-making process of where money goes, what determines national policies in developing countries, not to mention our.
I think ultimately these are spiritual questions. You know, you can find people who are selfish at all levels. You know, you can just be living with a begging bowl and a loincloth and be attached to your begging bowl.
We left Dean Ornish, who also is a board member of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. Among the CEOs and heads of state, there were also senior members of George Bush's administration. We found the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Christy Todd Whitman, hobnobbing near the stage where the South African group Ladysmith Black Mambazo was performing.
Ladysmith Black Mambazo is playing here now, and the protesters outside are saying it's this kind of cultural expression that is challenged by the World Economic Forum that leads to monoculture, etc.
Well, I don't believe that the World Economic Forum leads to monoculture, and I think one of the things that's wonderful about this is the kind of international interaction that occurs and the kinds of discussions. I go primarily to the informal world leaders, informal, the ICWELs they're called, and the discussions are far-reaching. The discussions are focused on how you provide technology to help developing nations. The idea that globalism is not something that is a force for evil, but in fact is offers enormous hope.
Finally, Enron. Do you think there should be criminal investigations of what went on and how, among other things, how many pensions, how much money workers have lost in their pension funds?
There obviously needs to be a very thorough investigation of what happened at Enron.
Enron's buying politicians!
It's robbed us all!
It's robbed us all!
Of our democracy!
Of our democracy!
With their bought politicians!
With their bought politicians!
They passed new laws!
They passed new laws!
To keep our air dirty!
To keep our air dirty!
Especially in Texas!
Especially in Texas!
With the help of a certain governor!
With the help of a certain governor!
How it was possible for the chief executives to be able to sell their stock when the people that put all their money into their pension and were stuck with that couldn't.
The billionaires for Bush and Bloomberg are here to explain that for too long, we've ruled this country from behind tinted windows of chauffeur-driven limousines, and we're here today to come out of the wealth closet. Now, one person's failed 401k is another corporate CEO's boondoggle, and it really, everybody's free to invest, and they reap the benefits, or they, you know, sink in dip times, but they should stop whining. Just do what Bloomberg does. Pick up, you know, a few million from the seat cushions of his couch and invest again. You know, the World Economic Forum stands for many things that we can get behind. For example, wealthy executives forever. But if you really need just a catchphrase to remember what the World Economic Forum means, I think we can just all agree that the World Economic Forum stands for Wasn't Enron Fun.
There's a lot that needs to be looked at from the financial point of view.
After talking to Christy Todd Whitman, we headed to the stage where Ladysmith Black Mambazo was playing, and we found Ambassador Nicholas Platt singing along to their signature song, Homeless. He's currently the president of the Asia Society, the Park Avenue nonprofit founded by John Rockefeller. Platt is an international financier. He's the former U.S. ambassador to Pakistan and the Philippines. He was a senior official at the Pentagon, and as the number two man under Bush Sr.'s Secretary of State George Shultz, Nicholas Platt was implicated in covering up the Iran-Contra scandal.
Ambassador Platt, can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
I wanted to ask what you think about the protests that have been going on outside of the World Economic Forum.
I haven't really been that aware of them. They've been kept away from us so much that we didn't really have a chance to figure out what they were saying. There was one that I heard that was really in favor of homeland defense.
We never managed to find that demonstration in New York that Ambassador Platt was talking about, the one in favor of homeland defense. Perhaps he was talking about some event happening inside the Oval Office or Pentagon.
But I have not had a sense of, they have not had an impact on me.
Throughout the weekend, more than 200 people were arrested. Scores were attacked by police wielding pepper spray and batons. The police erected barricades preventing the protesters from coming near the delegates to the World Economic Forum and their soirees. Back at the New York Stock Exchange with Ambassador Nicholas Platt.
One of the concerns expressed by the protesters is that the kind of people represented at the World Economic Forum hurt the general population of countries, for example, are the ones that support, in a place like Indonesia, corporations that have supported a military regime, and you as president of the Asia Society. What are your thoughts about that?
I don't think it's true. I mean, I think that the people at the World Economic Forum represent all different kinds of activities. A lot of them have created a lot of jobs in Asia. they have been as responsible, let's say, in China for the increase in standard of living as any other source. Foreign direct investment is what everybody wants because it creates jobs. I think everybody realizes now that globalization has created some gaps, and everyone's trying to figure out a way of making it fair, much fairer. But the people at the World Economic Forum are basically interested citizens of the world who are engaged in economic activity throughout the regions of the world and can't really be pigeonholed as people would want to. They don't fit. They're concerned, and they are also very productive.
As East Timor is about to be founded as a new country on May 20th, what are your thoughts about what U.S. policy has been in supporting the Indonesian regime that killed a third of the population there?
Well, I tell you that the U.S. has always been in favor of independence of East Timor, and my own personal feeling is that independence for East Timor came too early before anybody had a chance to really prepare.
Meaning that the Indonesians should have continued the occupation?
No, meaning that the Timorese that I knew wanted 5 to 10 years of autonomy under the overall auspices of Indonesia before being thrust out into the world.
What about the occupation, the Indonesian occupation, the level of support that it got from the United States with the military relationship, the sale of weapons? Only at the very end did the administration...
Those were related to our relationship with Indonesia, not to East Timor. East Timor was a separate issue.
But 200,000 people were killed there by Indonesian soldiers with U.S. weapons.
Yeah, but I'm keeping that as a separate issue.
From U.S. support for the Indonesian military regime?
U.S. and Indonesia have had relationships over the years. And we have a relationship now with the new regime, and there it is. And we've been supportive of East Timor, and we will continue to be.
Okay, thanks.
But I don't accept the tendency of people to sort of blame us for everything that happened.
You think the U.S. should have cut off support for Suharto before they did? In fact, they supported him to the very end, a man who financially, what is believed, took something like $4 billion and in terms of human rights. I mean, the level of debt.
The U.S. had its relationship with Indonesia over the years, and it was a very successful relationship for the United States and for Indonesia.
Successful in what way?
Just leave it at that.
Do you think it was worth the price, the U.S. support of Indonesia, given the number of lives lost?
Who do you represent?
My name is Amy Goodman.
Yes, and what's your... What axe are you grinding, my dear?
I survived the massacre in East Timor in 1991. What do you mean the stress management after?
If Ambassador Platt knew, he didn't let on. But I'd last dealt with the Asia Society in the early 1990s after the 1991 Santa Cruz massacre, in which U.S.-armed Indonesian soldiers gunned down more than 270 Timorese. Shortly after the massacre, the Asia Society honored the Indonesian dictator Suharto at a black tie affair in New York. The Society gave the names of journalists to the Indonesian military to vet and said we couldn't cover the event. Well, I showed up anyway with journalist Alan Nairn, who also survived the massacre with a fractured skull. The Asia Society had the police throw us out.
Homeless, homeless, Moonlight Stadium on a midnight lake. Homeless, homeless, Moonlight
it was a very successful relationship for the United States and for Indonesia.
Every day on the stock exchange floor, people are making a killing. On Saturday night, it seemed we were running into millionaires everywhere. Some were CEOs or currency speculators, others princes. Some just plain eccentric, like Swiss auctioneer and philatelist David Feldman. He certainly puts his stamp of approval on the World Economic Forum. He and his wife Fabienne count themselves as some of WEF founder Klaus Schwab's closest friends. They were surprised there were any protests at all.
I think the World Economic Forum has now become the leading networking organization for big business. The big businesses of the world getting together. Mm-hmm. There isn't anything else.
But as soon
so
as the,
attack
there's
them,
a gathering...
How can you get your message to them? Just go here.
Right. No.
But the thing is, as soon as there's a gathering of the more powerful, then, of course, there's a lot of protestation, which I understand. You know, it's very understandable. And but, you know, you can't just let them in the door.
I think that the idea of the forum has been always open for people to have a dialogue with protesting groups. And there's a formal way to do this. I don't think this is the way to do it, by in a certain sense of like immediacy, having to come to the very building where someone is having a meeting. And I got the feeling that they're not even sure what's going on at the meetings.
The World Economic Forum is a wonderful place where wealthy executives like ourselves can hobnob and network and plan corporate deregulation of industries and privatization of everything from water to media and education. And this really benefits the corporate bottom line, which is wonderful. I don't see why everybody out here is protesting.
If they only knew what was being discussed and how it was being discussed and how democratic or how humanistic some of the things were being done.
How democratic is it?
Is the forum.
Yeah.
In the meetings themselves, everybody has a right to speak.
I guess the question is not whether it's democratic within a meeting, but who gets to come to that meeting and speak.
Yes. The answer to that is yes. It's very difficult to choose. I think the World Economic Forum organized Klaus and people choose that. In the basis of the people that they know and who's made the media and who are important to them, looking into them. And how could you become democratic in a whole world of all of this? Terribly complicated.
In Europe, I mean, we've known groups coming in that are just ready to just smash things down and break things up, and that's really their message. They just take the opportunity of an international gathering to come and break up things. I don't know how it is in New York. I can't judge from what I saw. They were miles away from the Waldorf. They were very well kept in. I don't know if it broke out tonight. I don't know. Mm-hmm. The police was quite ready.
How many were there? How many?
I don't know what the numbers were. I think well over 10,000.
Really?
As many as that.
Have you ever protested in the streets over anything?
No. No.
The thing is, there's one thing between protesting and getting over-violent about it. You know, I think there can be a silent protest.
Talking to Fabienne Feldman reminded us of Maya Cash, of the billionaires for Bush or Bloomberg, who were out in the streets. In fact, we got a little confused as to who the real WEFer was.
We're saluting the Economic Forum. We're here to say that big money is united and these rabble-rousers aren't invited. We have a very simple explanation for global capitalism. World Economic Forum, WEF, equals wasn't Enron fun.
You know, I feel sorry for these people, really, because it's not easy to be out there protesting. And when they respect the rules, you know, you want to listen to them, but how can it be done?
If there's one image we'll take away from this evening in the heart of world financial power, the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, it's seeing the corporate titans, the captains of industry, the true global power elite, dancing, tapping their feet, rocking out to Ladysmith Black Mambazo's signature song, Homeless.
Homeless, homeless, moonlight sleeping on a midnight kiss. Homeless,
we are
homeless,
The moonlight's sleeping on the midnight lake. There'll be a homeless,
homeless,
homeless. Boom, boom, the moonlight's sleeping on the midnight lake.
Crashing the Stock Market, Democracy Now! Style was written and produced by Jeremy Scahill. It was shot and edited by Jackie Suin with help from Mark Reed. Lizzie Ratner was our researcher. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
In a building of gold with riches untold lived the families in which the country was founded. And the merchants of Star with their vain velvet smiles were there, for they also were hounded. And the soft middle class crowded into the last, for the building was fully surrounded. And the noise outside was the ringing of revolution. Sadly they stared and sank in their chairs and searched for a comforting notion. And the rich silver walls looked ready to fall as they shook in doubtful devotion. The ice cubes would clink as they freshened their drinks, wet their minds in bitter emotion. And they talked about the ringing of revolution.
The ringing of revolution. Phil Oakes, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. The Reebok Human Rights Awards are being given tonight in Salt Lake City on the eve of the Olympics. The awards recognize four activists age 30 or under, who international panels say have made significant contributions to the field of human rights through nonviolent means. This year, one of the winners has refused to accept the $50,000 award from Reebok. She's done so in protest against the low salaries Reebok pays its workers in Indonesia. She joins us now from Jakarta. Dita Sari is with us. Welcome to Democracy Now! Dita, are you there?
Yeah.
It's great.
Hi,
it's great to have you with us. You've been fighting for the rights of Indonesian workers for your entire life. When you were 21, you defied the laws of the then dictator Suharto and formed the first independent labor union in Indonesia. $50,000 certainly would have helped you in your struggle. Why have you turned it down?
Yeah. First, because the first time we know where the money comes from, the $50,000, it means 500 million rupiah. When we know that it comes from the Reebok, we also know that it comes also directly from the workers who got paid very low. Works in Reebok companies, whether in Indonesia and also in other third world countries. Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes. So right now you have turned down the award. Can you talk about the sneaker factory workers, the people, mainly women, who work in the Reebok and Nike factories?
Yeah, there are five biggest companies of Reebok operating in Indonesia, and all of them are subcontracted companies, and mostly subcontracted by South Korean people. And from the recent data that we got, it's about sports shoes that were exported to Europe and American, it is said that the contribution from this commodity for the owner of the brand, that is for Reebok directly, is 33% of the whole profit. But the contribution for paying the wages of the workers is only 0.4% of the whole cost of production. It means that the workers receive very, very low, only 0.4%, while the owner of the brand, that is the Reebok itself in the U.S., got 33% of the whole profit from the third world countries, such as Indonesia and Mexico. And now our minimum wage is less than $1.5 per day. Indonesia is the second lowest wages in Asian countries. So we think that we cannot tolerate how these multinational corporations such as Reebok and Nike and Adidas and Levi's and others treated our workers, not only about the minimum wage being very low for the wages, but also how they how their commitment to protect freedom of association, since we know that in many of the Nike companies, they dismissed lots of workers' activists.
You yourself, Dita Sari, spent time in Indonesia's jails under the dictator Suharto. Can you talk about why they put you in jail?
Because in 1996, we were leading a demonstration of 20,000 workers, mostly from the shoes and textile companies. And our demand at that time were increase of the wages, freedom of association, and we also demanded that the military stop their intervention in the labor dispute, since the military at that time were very powerful in every section of the society. So that makes the ruling power were very felt very disturbed about our demonstration and our activity, about our demands. So that's why they decided to put us in jail. But before 1996, we experienced a lot of harass and repression coming from the police. One was that was in 1995 when we organized a demonstration of a company who produced Adidas and Reebok. The name of the company is Indoshoes in the Industry, located in East Java, close to Jakarta. Their workers were 5,000 and mostly women. They were asking increase wages from $1 a day to $1.2 a day. But we found out that the police started to repress and harass physically the strikers at that time. So we know since that time that these kinds of companies not only paying the workers very low, but also can pay the police or the apparat to repress the strikers or the activists. So that's why I experience it myself. I see it with my own eyes, and I hear it myself. I heard it years before. And so it's not only from the statistics or data why we reject this award, but because I also experience it myself. So I know it very, very well, how these companies treat their workers, especially in the third world countries. So that's why we finally decided that it's not a proper thing to accept this award.
Dita Sari, we just played an interview that I did with the president of the Asia Society, Nicholas Platt, asking him about the U.S. relationship with Indonesia, which he says has been very beneficial. What do you think the U.S. should be doing about the situation in the fourth largest country in the world, Indonesia?
I think it is not wise, or it is not really a good decision of the U.S. government to start to open a military cooperation or military aid with the Indonesian government, since now we are trying really hard to make the military get out of politics and get out of interfering the life, social and political life also economic life in our country. We have fought for 10 years to get the dictatorship down, and we don't want it to come back. So if the U.S. government started to fund Indonesian military, whether it is in training, whether it is in any kind of assistance, we are afraid that it would create a sort of a confidence for the military to start to come back in our social life and also political life. And this is very dangerous since now the government has already adopted lots of idioms of terrorism. It's very worrying us, since we know that terrorism is not only related to the Islamic or the fundamentalist movement, but also can be also identified against the democratic movement.
On that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us from Jakarta, Indonesia. Again, congratulations on the Reebok Human Rights Award, or should I say, on your rejection of it. Dita Sari, who is imprisoned under the Suharto regime, rejecting the Reebok Human Rights Awards being given tonight on the eve of the Olympics in Salt Lake City. Dita Sari will not be there to receive hers. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
And then one day after 2 millennia, which after all was a small part of time, hundreds of souls found their way out of nowhere to be on Earth at the threat of decline. Now let's all go. They moved as one being, even though each would arrive here alone. They promised to work in grace with each other to brave the beautiful planet called home. There was no promise that they could save it, but how exciting to give it a try. If each one did just one thing beautifully, complex life on Earth might not die. And so they arrived in a spectrum of colors. The population on Earth did explode. Some threw themselves...
Planet Called Home. Holly Neer here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush's proposed budget would boost spending on fossil fuel and nuclear energy projects while cutting key environmental protection measures. On Monday, Bush sent Congress a $2 trillion budget proposal that expands military and national security spending while reducing funds for domestic programs. The slashes include nearly $300 million from the Environmental Protection Agency and more than $500 million from the Department of Transportation's air pollution reduction programs. All of this comes at the time of the massive protests here in New York against the World Economic Forum, where protesters were demonstrating against the nexus of state and corporate power. Among the events that took place were counter summits presenting protesters' own vision for a global world. One of those counter summits was called Globalizing Justice. It was put on by Students for Global Justice. Here is Patrick Rainsborough speaking, organizer, director for the Rainforest Action Network based in San Francisco.
Forum is about addressing the issues of our times, that these are the political, economic, and cultural elites who are going to solve the world's problems. I think it's appropriate that we here talk about the world's problems. So I want to start, unfortunately, with a bunch of bad news. Because from the perspective I'm coming, which is essentially a biocentric critique of the corporate global economy, there's a lot of very, very bad news. We're standing at a historic time when two significant historic themes are working themselves out in our generation. 500 years of colonialism and organized white supremacy and genocide and conquest in this hemisphere and around the world, and 200 years of rampant industrialization. And that's pushed us to the point where literally the life support systems of the planet are on the brink of collapse. I want to talk about some of the issues that I work on in terms of the world's forests. I don't know how many people out there know what an old-growth forest is, but it's a primary, fully functioning, intact forest ecosystem. Now, that means it's a forest that's never been impacted by human beings. And of the original old-growth forest cover of this planet, only 22% remains, less than one quarter. And a lot of people, particularly folks who are of the more urban set, might think, well, you know, what does that have to do with me? I'm busy fighting for justice in my own communities, fighting the issues that affect me. What do large tracts of wilderness have to do with me? And the reality is, an essential message that we need to get across to the world is that those forests and wilderness areas in general are the remaining intact biological wealth of this planet, the real wealth of this planet. Those 22% of the world's forests contain somewhere between 50 and 75% of all life on planet Earth, all plant and animal species. They contain around 75% of all traditional indigenous cultures, remaining in the tiny chunks left of the world's old-growth forests. Yet they continue to fall at an alarming rate. Likewise, we're seeing the ecological crisis expressed in what's loosely called global warming, but is much more accurately called global climate destabilization. It's continually amazing to me because we are fortunate, despite the incredible corporate censorship of the media, to have a lot of information at our disposal, a lot of times too much information. And for folks who follow the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, it's amazing to me that these stories get tucked away on page 17, page 18, page 24. The latest findings from this panel, which is made up of about 1,500 of the world's top climate scientists, is that we can expect over the next century our planet, planet Earth, to heat up between 3 and 10 degrees. 3 to 10 degrees centigrade. Now, to put that in perspective, the last ice age was about varying at different times between 3 and 7 degrees cooler. Those are the type of cataclysmic global changes we're talking about, the kind of destabilization that we're looking at over the next century, happening rapidly. The folks who are actually, interestingly enough, tracking a lot of the impacts of global warming expressed through extreme weather are the insurance industry. And the world's largest reinsurer, Munich Re, has compiled a great deal of statistics about the price tag that global warming is costing them. And in 1998 alone, the year at which global warming has taken the most significant impact, the price tag of global warming, which we hear very little about, was $87 billion, was 300 million people who lost their homes and were displaced, and 32,000 people who were killed. So when we think, what are the real issues of our times underlying a lot of the symptoms that we see? We're currently living through the sixth mass extinction on planet Earth right now. As we speak, the Smithsonian Institute estimates that today, while we were all going about our business of trying to create a global justice movement, that approximately 374 plant and animal species went extinct. The reality is they really have no idea because they don't know how many species are left in the world's forests as they're being cut down. But what that means is essentially we're shredding the web of life. This is a biological meltdown, and it gets to one of the big flawed assumptions of our times. Our entire society is encouraged to think that humanity is the most important species on the planet. Now, the reality is humanity is just one strand within a web of life. We're dependent on the rest of this web of life. We're dependent on it for clean air, clean water, for the medicines and food crops we rely on. And essentially, when we get into these false debates about jobs versus the environment, or whether we can afford to make the kind of global transitions that are needed to deal with the global ecological crisis, and say, why should we save one snail-toed starter species here, or this type of slug? The reality is, if you look at planet Earth as an incredibly complex machine, something we don't really understand, think of it as an airplane. Now, you'd have to be a pretty foolish mechanic flying on your airplane to open up the engine and say, I don't know what this one does. Let's pull that one out of there. I don't know what this cog does. Let's pull that one out of there. That's literally what we're doing. We're not taking little snips at the web of life. We're shredding the web of life. And we stand at this point in a very exciting time, a historic juncture in this larger battle we're all a part of, in the struggles between civil society and corporate rule. The struggle between a people's globalization and corporate globalization. The decision about what is going to be globalized, Because that's the biggest lie that they've tried to perpetuate about us, is that we're not globalizers, that we want to live in isolation, that we want to live in a vacuum. The reality is we're the original think globally, act locally people. We're the original people who recognized along our movements and the basis with a lot of traditional societies that we have only one planet and we have to be better stewards of it. So we stand looking at a choice. We can have a vibrant, diverse world where there's traditional indigenous cultures, where there's a wealth of life that's part of supporting us and living in conjunction with us, or we can descend in the direction that those involved in the World Economic Forum and the corporate globalizers want, which is essentially global corporate consumer monoculture. Because ultimately that's what they're about. They're about the death of diversity. They're about the death of life. They're about homogenization and assimilation. And one of the things that a lot of times we don't hear, because our movement can sometimes be a little self-congratulatory a little too early, is that there's nothing particularly new about globalization. Globalization, certainly in this hemisphere, has been going on for 500 years, and there's been resistance for 500 years, and that resistance is continuing. And I'd like to read to you from a communique that was sent out to the world from a community of people in Colombia, a traditional indigenous community called the Uwa people. Are folks familiar with the Uwa and their struggle? People have heard about them. These are messages that have resonated around the world and are a true example of our globalization, the globalization of hope and democracy and justice and environmental protection. But the Uwa, for those of you who don't know, is they're not an uncontacted people, but they are an unassimilated people. And in fact, as part of their stories, the way they resisted colonization was for a clan of the Uwa in the 1600s to commit collective suicide by walking backwards over a 1,600-foot cliff, the cliff of death, as they call it. And the remainders of their society lived quite peacefully in their cloud forest homes in what's now northeastern Colombia until the early 90s, when a new wave of conquistadors showed up in their territory. The conquistadors of multinational oil corporations who were looking for the black gold underneath their land. The oil that they call Ruira in their own language, the blood of Mother Earth. So as this campaign intensified and they began to realize the destruction that oil exploitation would bring to their communities, not only in terms of environmental destruction and the destruction of their values and their homeland, but bringing the incredibly bloody civil war that's raging in Colombia into their territory, they decided to make a very powerful statement and send it out to the world that rather than be killed, rather than be assimilated, rather than lose their homelands and their way of life, they would choose again to commit collective suicide. And they sent this message out to the world. This is from August 10th of 1998. And this is a message that if it had come from Mars, it would be on the front page of every newspaper. The reality is the sentiments in this statement are so distant from the underlying twisted values of global capitalism that it could have come from Mars. The words of the Uwa people. Oil is the blood of Mother Earth. And to take the oil is, for us, worse than killing your own mother. If you kill the earth, then no one will live. We will in no way sell our Mother Earth. To do so would be to give up on our work of collaborating with the spirits to protect the heart of the world, which sustains and gives life to the rest of the universe. It would be to go against our own origins and those of all existence. We are seeking an explanation for this progress that goes against life. We are demanding that this kind of progress stop. That oil exploitation in the heart of the earth is halted, that the deliberate bleeding of the earth stop. We ask that our brothers and sisters from other races and cultures unite in the struggle that we are undertaking. We believe that this struggle has to become a global crusade to defend life. That's a communique from 1998 that helped launch an international solidarity movement against an oil company and, most importantly, against the financial institutions that back them up. And it speaks to a lot of the flawed assumptions of our time, what's meant by progress, what's meant by development, what's meant by a fossil fuel-based economy. Fundamentally, the belief that we're separate from the earth and we're not dependent on the earth, that the earth is ours to rape and pillage, to exploit, to commodify for personal gain. Behind that, that the model by which we should assess our progress is one of unlimited economic growth. I like to think of it as the flowchart mentality. Over here we have resources in the middle we have incredibly complex, intricate systems that we've worked out to make out lots of cool stuff. Resources in, cool stuff, pollution out. And we never think about which direction these things are going in, and realizing that we live on a planet that's bound within certain limits, and we must respect those. As a radical ecologist, I look to nature for my models of meaningful social structure. And when I look at what the global capitalist economy has created, I can see only one thing in nature that represents it. And that is, as it's been said so eloquently, the ideology of the cancer cell. Something based on unlimited growth till it literally pushes to the point where we kill the host. That host is us, planet Earth. And essentially what we're looking at, what the World Economic Forum is offering us up, and offering us up in their twisted logic as progress and prosperity, is actually a doomsday economy, pushing us within the next generation to the largest biological and ecological crisis this planet has ever seen. So that was the bad news. The good news, fortunately, is when you follow this metaphor through and you look to the natural world, fortunately, I think there's something that's already happening that we all represent. And that's that an organism under attack will create antibodies. And the antibodies will grow and they'll spread and they will identify the invader and they will work to transform it. And I think that's what's happening all around us. We're seeing a push towards transformative culture. People are recognizing that in this generation, we don't have the choice to not be radicals. To paraphrase my favorite Thoreau quote, Thoreau says, "For every 1,000 people hacking at the branches of the tree of evil, only one is hacking at the root." That's our job, to ensure that more and more people start hacking at the root. And very briefly, in conclusion, I want to suggest to you what I think that root is. And I think that where we'll find it is when we look to the actual assumptions of the global financial system itself and the people who are running the global economy. I look at the financial system, and particularly the giant private banks. I'm involved with an international coalition running a campaign against Citigroup, the largest financial institution on the planet. And to me, I've come to recognize that as one of the key nerve centers of global destruction, the jugular of the global economy, the flow of money around the planet. And then it's essential for our movement to step forward and recognize that the ecological crisis is a symptom of a deeper crisis, a crisis in democracy. And as long as we allow the same corporations that profit off of this narrow vision of destroying the life support systems of the planet, as long as we allow these people to write the rules of the global economy, we're never going to solve the ecological crisis. We're never going to have a democratic, just, and ecologically sane global society. And so I'm very excited by the movement that's emerging in this country in solidarity with the traditions of popular resistance around the world, where people are recognizing that the age of single-issue politics is over, that we're all in this together, environmentalists, students, people of faith, anarchists, communists, labor organizers. We're creating one movement that's diverse enough to create space for all of us and diverse enough to actually get to the root of this problem. So I want to end on one point that provides a lot of inspiration for me, and that's a pretty bumper sticker version of Schopenhauer's Models of Truth, a 19th century philosopher who says that truth goes through three different stages. The first is ridicule, and I think a lot of us in our work have been ridiculed. The second is violent repression. And there's been a whole lot of violent repression around the world, and we're starting to get a real taste of it here in this country. And then finally, the third phase is that the truth is accepted as self-evident. And that's what's happening. We're part of a common sense revolution, a revolution in consciousness, a revolution that's affirming basic values of supporting life and democracy and justice. And I think that these are spreading. And I want to thank everybody here for all the work that they've done and the work that they'll continue to do and what will happen in the streets this weekend and, more importantly, what will happen when we all go back home.
Patrick Rainsborough, Rainforest Action Network. Special thanks to Miranda Kennedy, Anthony Sloan, Orlando Richards. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high.